Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow it just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. Hope you guys had a great 4th of July weekend, Independence Day. You're probably going to hear, let's see where I'm at, it's still light for another half hour. I think most of those, we're in one of those unfortunate cities where private citizens are allowed to play with explosives and many times do that with alcohol involved. And so the news is quite interesting last night and tonight, but we had a thunderstorm come through last night. So people only got part of their stuff done the 3, 4, 5 days before that. So if in about a half hour it starts sounding like a war zone, we're not expecting rain tonight, but they did call off a couple organized events. And then the disorganized in the neighborhood, boy, do I hope that they ran out of their stuff. But you know, in deference to people that have animals, whether they're domestic or wild animals, you know, their sense of navigation is thrown off from that noise and they can get hurt or injured. I hear 1 out of 5 dogs run away the 4th of July, and the 4th of July is the biggest time where animals are lost. They run off because they're afraid. They want to run off and hide and escape from all the noise. And not the least, the other demographic is people with PTSD. Obviously, for our veterans, those who have been downrange and been in combat, for many of those individuals, it's not a good feeling and some triggers in there, especially if it's like it is around here, a city that lets everybody play with fireworks for 5 or 6 days because it's just constant explosions. And then when you go outside, it smells like smoke, the acrid smell of all the fireworks smoke. And so, as you can see, maybe where I stand on it, I think organized firework displays where a person can be prepared and choose to be far away with the TV up or go and hopefully be safe and watch, I think those things are great. But I wish more people would think about the animals, the people who work even, you know, there's people that work. Because of that rainstorm, people had to work today, right? The 4th was yesterday, today was the 5th. So, you know, people were up till 1 or 2 in the morning, even though the curfew is 11, shooting fireworks, people with babies, sick people who need their sleep. And there's so many people that are affected. But our freedom is a big celebration. But not a free license, I think, to drink and have amateurs playing with explosives out there. And as our news indicated, a couple of fires, homes started on fire around the city. One, I don't know what the heck they did, but it showed a picture of a house, like, from the corner, and fireworks were exploding inside the house. I'm not quite sure what happened there. And then they go on to talk about the injuries. You know, someone, most often it's an eye or eyes because, or fingers, hands, because something blows up in someone's face. So their face, their eyes, last night somebody lost part of a finger. They were just talking about some of the emergency room deals on the 10 o'clock news last night. And, of course, the fireworks didn't start, well, in earnest for the evening until it got dark at 9:30. But they were probably looking at all day, you know, what had happened. And so between the property damage and the personal injury and all of the parties involved, our mayor is listening just a tiny bit. She used to give them 2 weeks. God, was that horrible. Now they sell them, get this, and tell me how effective you think this is. They start selling them 5 days ahead, but you're not supposed to use them until 3 days ahead. Now, what do you think the chances are of that? I'll tell you, nothing. Nothing. But anyway, I hope you guys had a happy Independence Day. And last night I was thinking about Simon. By the way, I guess I did my generic intro, and this is Kim Justice. I'm your regular Wednesday host of Recovery Now. On the last Wednesday of each month, I'm honored to have a co-host, Simon Lewis. I was ill last Wednesday and wasn't able to do my show. And so I played a previous show from 2015. Dr. Evan Alexander was talking about, now he was a neurosurgeon who got hydrocephalus and nearly died, had a near-death experience. Very interesting story. And I bet it was new to a lot of you that listened, because 2015 was quite a while ago when most of us can't remember what we had for lunch. We wouldn't remember the particulars, but in any case, we're going to kick off July the first of the month. Don't want to mess you up out there, but Simon is with me kicking off on the first Wednesday of this month. I'm going to read a couple preliminaries, bring Simon on, and then our good friend Michael from sunny Florida is going to give us a report. We like to get periodic reports of what he's up to, because he's one of the most ambitious what's the word I'm trying to think of? Well, I'll leave it in at ambitious, but versatile, accomplished so many things, never says never, keeps going until his goals are met. And a great example among the world of brain injury, so we're going to let him come on. But for those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a we recovery program, because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. So, if you'd like to know more about me, you can check out my website, inaflash.org. That's how quickly our lives can change, right? Inaflash.org. And Simon Lewis, L-E-W-S, if you want to know more about Simon, you can check out a couple of websites, Rise and, spelled out, riseandshinethebook.com, and or simonlewis.us. Now, tonight, I'll tell you what we're going to be talking about, and then we're going to just bring on, I'll bring Simon on, tell him hi, and then he is aware that Michael is going to do our roving reporter information from down in Florida. So what did I say? I said Simon and I normally do, do our show on the last Wednesday of each month. However, this time we're going to kick off the new month and recognize our independence. Before and after brain injury. I was sick last week, so we deferred to now, and I appreciate Simon rolling with me on that. In the meantime, I'm going to go on just a little more Simon, and we do have another caller, so I think I'm going to take our caller too, and maybe I'll do that before I read what our topic is going to be. We'll take care of these callers first, but let me pull Simon on, and then Michael, if you'll wait for just a moment. Simon, welcome to the show.
Happy Independence Day, Kim. It's a delight to wish you a happy Independence Day and to talk about independence before and after brain injury. And as you would say, without further ado, I first of all wish you well, because for you to miss a show because of not being well, I really wish you well. And I'll step aside without further ado so you can take Michael's call and the other the calls that we best do the calls.
Yes, why don't we do that? Michael, I will be right with you. Don't hang up, but I want to see real quick like your 928. Who's this?
Hi, it's Bob. How are you?
Fine. How are you, Bob?
I'm doing good. I like the show. I do listen to it when I can.
Great. Well, we appreciate that. If
Thank
you want
you,
to
Bob.
Hit one, yes, Bob, we really appreciate that.
I wanted to tell you something about the show and about something that happened to me today. I won't stay on long. Is that okay?
Sure.
I went to Taco Bell, and I went with my grandma, and then I took a huge, ate it, and it got stuck in my teeth. Poop is in my teeth.
Okay, Michael. Michael, so glad to have you here. Apologies, that was a troll, and I had a feeling it was. So we're going to let him go, and I'm happy to have you. Tell us what's going on in sunny Florida. That was
I'm sorry. Yeah,
I didn't realize
what he was, whatever you call him. And I was trying to see what I could say for him. Anyway, hello all my brothers and sisters in the traumatic brain injury community. My injury happened.
Hello, Michael.
Hello,
Simon.
Yes,
Simon.
Right. Look, I even forgot your name because I have a traumatic brain injury. I just wanted to let you guys know that all my brothers and sisters in the traumatic disabled community, for veterans, for aging as I'm doing, and people in our community, I've been working on Moby mats. Moby mats are plastic mats that go from the edge of the cement all the way down to the almost water's edge, but not all the way because we're not allowed to go all the way. But I've been talking about them for a long time now. I live in Pinellas County, Florida, and Pasco County, Florida. I installed 5 of them in. But Pinellas County, Florida now has 20 mats laid throughout the county for us with disabilities to take down to the water and sit with our families and enjoy our beaches.
Fantastic.
And that's what I wanted to say. And I'm glad that Kim allows me to talk about it on the program, because I do live in Florida and it's kind of late down here.
And I'm so glad that you call in, because I know that you're an hour later down there. But one of the things, a couple things just really quick, is I remember when you divined the idea and then the process that you've been through to get the first mat laid, let alone to get mats on the drawing board laid now.
Yeah, it took me 7 years. 7 years to get to this point. And I'm finally done after 7 years. It was tough, Kim. It was tough. Some of the agencies I had to go to get their permission, you know?
Yes.
Michael?
Yes.
To lay nuts. I didn't realize it took so long. But I stuck with it, and I persevered, and I did what they told me to do. And I'm talking about government agencies. I'm not talking about I'm talking about, as you well know, Kim, because I told you on previous shows. But I got it done, and I'm very happy.
Well done.
Well, we're very happy, too.
Thank you.
Yes, I was
Thank
just
you.
Going to say.
Thank you,
Michael. Thank you.
How long, because of the ocean and the salt air, do you have a sense of how long these will help people reach the ocean who have challenges to get to the water?
Well, no, these mats will, I never really spoke about that, because these mats are well built, they're well maintained, they maintain it because they can be rolled up when a hurricane's coming. They roll them up, and during turtle season I'm not allowed to lay one. And turtle season goes from the beginning of June to the end of October. So what they do is they roll them up or leave them down, because the turtles know not to walk on them.
No.
or something. I really don't know. But I've been waiting 7 years to get these things laid.
Oh,
that is just incredible. Your tenacity is inspiring.
Yep.
But the other thing, I'm not trying to take tourists away from your state. In fact, by having you on, I like people to know that, 20 different places down in your area for people looking for a vacation destination who may have some mobility issues for whatever reason. I can't think of anything worse, having been to Florida many times, to not be able to get close to the ocean and the spray, you know, of the water, and have that feeling of being one with. I can't imagine having to stand back behind the seawall to admire it and never get that close
because
to the water.
That's where usually the cement is, you know, behind the walls. And think of how many people can now take their chairs down and sit with their families, you know?
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So great destination for vacationers, but I also like to have you on because there's a few other places surrounded by ocean, and even in your own state, but California, where Simon is, and all kinds of other states about the ocean, and this, you've made such a good example of Florida and being a great destination location for people with mobility challenges to be able to enjoy the warm sunshine and the sea spray and all the beauty down in your state. And I hope that that inspires other states to do the same. And you've been a dynamic voice for helping people to be able to access, you know, accessibility to places that they've never been able to access before. And what a tremendous gift that is, that you not only divined that idea, but have seen it through many agencies, many talks, a lot of paperwork, and sweat equity for 7 years, to get this done over a period of 7 years. So congratulations to you and to your state for being, you know, your area there, for being a great vacation spot, and for being an inspiration to other beaches around the country that I hope will follow suit. And if they ever doubt it,
I can only imagine
they could do
the
it,
challenges
they could.
In California.
Yeah, I'm a man that works very hard, because that's what I learned from, you know, my family and all. But I don't look for any of the, you know, any of the glamour. I'm just behind the scenes and all, you know? And so when you watch a thing about my Moby Mats, I'm not the man that they interview. I let people that are in wheelchairs give an interview, you know, people that really need to use the mat. But I always cut the ribbons. I'm always there cutting the ribbons with the mayors and all, you know.
That's wonderful.
That's another thing
about
me.
As you should be. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
20 ribbons cut and 20 beaches helped with.
Yeah, let me let you and Simon talk now. Thank you very much. I dearly appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
Him. All right.
Well, we love
you,
Michael.
Later.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks
Thank
for
you.
All your hard work.
Bye.
Appreciate you coming.
All right.
Bye-bye. Boy, isn't he a piece of work at Simon?
He is such an advocate.
I know.
Such an advocate that helps people.
And a hard worker, you know. I just want to say that he had to approach so many state government and local government agencies and pitch to people who were probably busy, maybe not interested initially when he got a hold of them, or too busy, didn't have the time. Not everybody just threw the door open and let him in the door to have his say. But Michael's a really big guy, and he's Italian. A New York Italian that moved down there, and he's got some, as he would say, he's got some brothers, too, that would go and visit with him. But, you know, incredibly, he was able to get his foot in the door and have the courage to pitch and not worry about how it sounded, how he sounded. He didn't let anything external get in the way of his mission, and then carried through and presented his mission to people, you know, who I don't know if I can fairly say that people in government position that we would find them at a stature way above ours these days. But nonetheless, you know, speaking to anyone, the head of a corporation, you know, the head of a government agency, none of that is easy. You know, those people are not easy to get access to, you know, and not only did he do that and did he do his pitch, but he did it successfully. And I think it's awesome. I didn't know till tonight that he gets to be there with the mayors and the whoever's when the ribbon gets cut. He does deserve that. And it's neat that they interview the people who've had an opportunity to have a completely different experience with the ocean than they've ever gotten to have before. So anyway, I think that's awesome. And one thing he didn't tell us, I was telling him that we had been having a falling problem. And Michael told me, and I'll just make it brief because he left, I think he had to get a couple of stitches, but he was running and slipped and fell 2 weeks ago and didn't think anything happened. He wound up, you know, getting himself up and going about doing whatever it was he had to do, and then realized that he was bleeding profusely, and it was about a 3-inch cut on his arm. Something clipped his arm. And I was just telling him, we only had 2 minutes, and I said, oh, I see Simon just came on. I said, you know, Simon had an issue with a fall more recently, and I did a few weeks ago. And so before we do, I just want to read real quick, like, because we'll just see how much of this we talk about. But here was what I thought I'd let the callers on for. You know, the reason why I let on the troll, which I didn't know it was a troll, but we had an original host for a short time. So that would have been 13-plus years ago. And I understand that he died. And he was only 59. And I don't know why he died. I need to get the details from someone we know in common. But one thing I do know is that he was in Florida, at least last time I knew he was in Florida. But had a bad temper as long as I knew him, a lot of anger, some drinking. Ultimately, he wound up homeless. And from there, I'm not sure what took his life, but I am sorry that that happened. So hopefully I'll be able to tell y'all. And that was a Florida area code. And so I wondered if the woman that let us know that he passed away was maybe calling in is the only reason I picked up the call. But when I heard it was Bob, I had a feeling we had something more coming. But, you know, I would recommend, we all know that emotion regulation and anger can be an issue with brain injury and often is. And he had multiple brain injuries. And I would really encourage people to consider the fact that we're still responsible. And, you know, seek therapy where we're acting out in ways that get us beat up, alienate us from other people, so that we're in a lonely, polarized place. Take treatment plans like CBT, cognitive behavior therapy. I took DBT, dialectic behavior therapy. There was a whole, it's a four-part program, and one of the modules, is the word I was looking for, is on emotion regulation, and it teaches you new ways. You know, I don't know what people had modeled for them coming up and then have a brain injury and life doesn't go the way that they planned it to go and different things feed the beast, but our part of the responsibility in there is that for everything that's feeding the beast, you know, hanging on by the skin of our teeth and doing what we can to mitigate that feeding the beast and changing our behavior in a way that is less disruptive to our lives. And it isn't easy, and it takes a lot of practice, like a lot of things. You know, you can't be a marathon runner if you've never put on a pair of tennis shoes, probably. You know, a lot of practice, a lot of dedication. But in any case, I won't go further because I don't know the details, except that he had been suffering in his life a lot. And, you know, 59, that's young, you know, young time to leave this earth, and especially after having struggled so much the last number of years. So for that, I'm sorry.
If I could say a few words, Kim, I first of all, I think it's absolutely beautiful that, and so in keeping with the goal of helping people with brain injury or encouraging them, that from Bob, the caller who turned out to be making a troll call, instead of a criticism, you brought us into a learning opportunity because of the anger and the isolation that might lead somebody to make a destructive troll call. I think that's so wise of you. And then to point to programs to try to encourage people to pursue solutions who may feel isolated, angry, and wanting to act out in a way. With and even the joke or the troll thing that he was trying to do before, thank goodness you cut him off, is indicative of a kind of a brain injury issue, because he started out saying that he enjoyed the show, which I suspect was a true statement. Clearly he found the show and he's been listening to the show. And then, which is not unusual with brain injury, he started saying things that were the kind of negative jokes that children make. And that is something which is a dysregulation of behavior. It's his voice sounded like he was a mature man, but he was making a joke that somebody who is a child might make, a very young child.
Well.
So I just wanted to say, Kim, I thought it was beautiful that you then turned that, if he is still listening, into an opportunity for him to seek encouragement and guidance to try to, a step at a time, improve his situation in terms of his learning appropriate ways to communicate, and that will help him in the future, or may. That's always the goal, is to try to help. So I just wanted to cut in and say that. And the other thought that I had for what you were saying is that we're talking about the brain and brain injury and pain. And I did think, and I hadn't thought about this before, Kim, you and I, we talked a little bit about what our show will be about, but I was reflecting on people I've interacted with, and specifically people who have suffered addiction. And we all know the addiction prayer, to know the difference between what you can do or deal with and what you can't. But one common thing about the steps to recovery that an addict will say, because I've come across quite a few in my time, they will always tell me instantly exactly how long they have been sober. Exactly. One person is, I think it was over 15 years. They've been sober 15 years, 7 months, and they count the days as part of the healing. And so coming back to brain injury and pain, I think that there are similarities with the length of time that one should be thinking about, like the original host, who had these anger issues, managing anger, managing the effect of brain injury, where a person says things and does things that are unrestrained, is a symptom, and the process of overcoming that symptom, that well-known symptom, like addiction, is one day at a time to change those behaviors. And with extreme cases, it may not be possible. We don't want to trade in false hope or just think positive, but the work of brain injury rehabilitation is one day at a time, like addiction, one day at a time, year in, year out.
Well, and I appreciate those comments and input. There's something else I remember back then. One thing we have to do, too, is help ourselves, not only in doing coursework and the kind of things I was talking about, but this person had a very toxic relationship. Thought he was in love with someone, and I guess she must have thought the same, because like a moth and a flame, they kept coming back together, but it was always horrible and tragic. And they were two people that brought out the worst in each other, hands down. And it was talked about a lot on the show. So, you know, I could go back a million years and probably find a bunch of shows where this was talking about. But, you know, all people kept saying was to both of them, you need to get away. You know, if you're a moth in a flame or you put your hand on the stove, you're going to get burnt. This is one of those where everybody on earth could see the train coming down the track, you know. Oh. 100 miles an hour and them standing right in the middle of the tracks, and they would not get off the tracks. And so there's certain things like that when you were talking about, you know, recovery from addiction. And one of the things is, you know, looking deeply into yourself and your character defects, or what they call it. You know, your character defects, and recognizing that's where the awareness comes from. And then the acceptance that no matter how much you want something, sometimes it just isn't good for you, and it's going to diminish the quality of your life and everyone around you, and no good is going to come of it. And so sometimes we have to accept that everything we want isn't something that we need that is going to make our life a more sense of quality of life. You know, it's going to go backwards. And then we need to take the action, no matter how painful or challenging or difficult that might be. But I don't want to. There's a lot of things in life we don't want to do. I bet 100%, 99% of the people listening tonight who have a brain injury got up the day they were injured, didn't know what was coming ahead that was going to change their life and turn it upside down. Nobody wanted that, but it happened. And if there was something we could have done to prevent it, we would have, but we were taken completely off guard. If there was a lapse back there where we were able to see, you know, at 30 minutes ahead what was going to happen, you know, we might be able to divert the horror that came after. And that's true, you know, of toxic relationships, is when you keep repeating. Another phrase from recovery is when you keep repeating the same behavior expecting different results, that's the definition of insanity. And so if you keep doing the same thing, you're going to keep getting the same results until you're willing to accept that it's not good for you, that you're willing to take the action, no matter what it takes, to step back, push yourself away from the table, head a different direction, and then adapt to having a healthy lifestyle instead of being so entrenched in a negative, painful lifestyle, that you really have a chance to feel joy in yourself and spread joy among others instead of perpetual toxicity and pain. And I will say that he and I really didn't get along, but I am extremely sorry. You know, for his early passing and whatever the circumstances were, I will probably know some of it. I just don't know the exact thing that took his life at the moment that it did, but he hadn't been in a good place for a long time, and I just tried to practice avoidance. You know, he got me angry a few times, and you know what I had to do with that was know that I wasn't ever going to be able to change him, but engaging with him was absolutely the wrong thing to do, because that fed his beast. That's what he was looking for. That's what he was looking for in the relationship he kept going back to. Was someone to find, take deference in, say something that he could take as a we're on, you know, the gauntlet's down kind of thing. And I just, anyway, I'm sorry, and I hope that I will find out more soon about what happened to him in the case that I may or may not ever identify. That'll be up to Craig, really. But if there's a lesson to be learned for the rest of us here, then it might be good to know, because it might save some lives. And that would be poetic for the torturous life that he was living last I heard. If some lessons from his life could save someone else's life, then, you know, his life has even more value. But in any case, what I didn't read today, and I do want to talk a little bit about what the program notes say, is our evolution of brain injury and the study of pain in recent years, old original assumptions have shifted. It used to be said that the brain didn't feel pain. Now science is recognizing that the brain has connections to tissues of chronic pain that loop back to specific parts of the brain. One such discovery comes by the name of central sensitization, or central sensitivity syndromes. Our brain injuries can and do alter our central nervous system and cause a convergence of chronic pain conditions, adding to our original brain injury residuals. Now, Simon and I aren't doctors, only survivors who crack the books and pass on information of interest that hopefully you'll find helpful. Now, my doctor, before we get into this topic, I wanted to be able to flip to the chat room, so I wanted to let you know what we were thinking about talking about tonight. But because I'm starting to hear fireworks come off, I was thinking of Simon last night. Many of you know Simon hails from England, and I was watching a show on the revolution last night, and I couldn't help but think of you. Initially, when the Redcoats came to Boston, what was the battle before the Tea Party, though? It was,
That
I know this
Massacre.
Like the back of my... Well,
wouldn't that be the Boston Massacre?
Well, they did have the Boston Massacre. I'm trying to think about... There was a hill. Thank you, Bunker Hill. It was interesting because the soldiers were told to go up Bunker Hill. There were two hills next to each other, and they were told to go up Bunker Hill and dig trenches so that they could kind of have some blockage and get the British soldiers as they were coming up the hill. Well, somebody told them the wrong hill, the one next door, which also started with a B. And it actually was closer to where the British brigade was, and they really outnumbered, the rebels. The Patriots, they outnumbered them, but because of being told wrong, the Battle of Bunker Hill wound up happening, but they really wiped out a lot of the soldiers on their way to Bunker Hill by being on the wrong hill next door. So that was pretty interesting. And then, there was the Boston Massacre and the Tea Party. But I was just thinking about how, when Britain sent thousands of troops to Boston it really, you know, they heard that rebels, there was some rebels that were getting sick of the taxation without representation issue. You know, there's so much in history. I read something the other day about the Constitution, that it doesn't need to be rewritten, it needs to be reread. And I thought that was interesting, because watching this show last night, in deference to the 4th of July, Independence Day, watching some history about the Revolutionary War, that there's a lot to be taken from that. You know, we don't like taxation without proper representation. And some of that's going on today. You know,
yes, that's always about
a
the
lot
money.
Of, yeah, yeah, always about the money. We got the taxation, and a lot of parties feel that they're not being represented the way that they had hoped when they gave
saying,
that money.
Which is when people say it's not the money, it's the principle. It's the money.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It is definitely. Well, it's definitely the money. And then when, you know, if they wouldn't have sent in, because I try to imagine it. Now, I know that we'll go into some different kind of racism, and maybe you can tell me, but it appears to me from things that I've watched that the proper English didn't think much of the Irish and the Scottish, like they were the low end. And maybe not all English people feel that way, but I do know that the way that a lot of you know that I'm in Daughters of the American Revolution, and I have so far I have 8 patriots, meaning 8 people in the direct line of my descendants who fought in the American Revolution.
You're wonderful.
And yeah, and I'm not even done looking. There's a couple more that I know fought. I just haven't put the pieces together to connect them. DAR is very, very, very strict. You can't go by family stories or anything really besides birth certificates, marriage certificates, death certificates, going all the way back from you to, what is that, about 6-7 generations back when they fought the revolution. So you're going back a ways. And these aren't uncles or aunts. It's a straight line right from you back. And then of course, you know, people get married, so it might be their family. But those people, all of those 8 that I just told you about were I always thought just Irish. As it turns out, with the DNA test, I found out there is a good deal of Irish, but some Scots Irish in there too. And I remember there was a time, I heard tell, that they dropped a bunch of leaflets. You know, Ireland was always at war. Always. You know, it wasn't just when England took them over and made a settlement, you know, out of Northern. And I wonder how many out of Northern Ireland is what I was going to say. And then there's the island of Ireland, but up north where, you know, the English sent in settlers, I wonder how many generations it took those settlers to consider themselves Irish, you know, and not English settlers. Because, for example, one of the, they don't call it a province, what do they call the different, in any case, one of them now is called Londonderry. And that was a name that England gave it. But the Irish will forever call it Derry because that was the
How
name
interesting.
Of it. That's what it is. It's D-E-R-R-Y, Derry. Boom. They don't use Londonderry. That was an English thing. The Ireland thing is that it was always County Derry and always will be County Derry. But anyway, they were a worn, torn, impoverished country. And at one point, the proper English who were settled in New England were frightened of the Native Americans, you know, this new land, new country, and life was a lot different, you know, than it was over in England. And when they found out what was on the other side of the mountains, it was scary. So some leaflets were dropped in Ireland that they'd be given free land if they were willing to come to this country. And a bunch of them thought, wow, well, you know, we've been in war forever. We've been, can't get a potato to save your soul around here, you know, this year. Great famine and disease yes. and wars. It's just, for as beautiful a country as it is, they didn't have a lot of peace at the time. So many started flooding over. And the free land that they got was on the other side of the mountains between the proper English and the Native Americans. And so they were the wall, if you will, the brutes, you know, from the Irish and the Scottish heritage that were going to be what stood between the Native Americans and the proper English to keep them safe. You'd have to go through a wall of Irish and Scottish folks. And
interesting.
The other side of my family is Italian. Now, the Italians were late to the party. They didn't come till much later. And so no patriots in the Italian end of things. That came later. But the Scottish and the Irish were some of the first to come to this, and the English, of course, some of the first to come to this country. But it is interesting because of the people that were here, we think later about the Civil War, but going back to the Revolution for a minute, you know, you took the Americans, when I asked the question, I wonder how long it took those Irish to consider themselves Irish citizens and not English transplants, how many generations it took. And, you know, at the time here, you know, there were a lot of our citizens who were loyal to the crown, loyal to England. And then another batch that were the first that started considering themselves Americans, citizens of America, and they thought they should be running their country and having a say in that rule system about the taxation and all the rest. And the rest, as we say, is history. But anyway, when I heard that thing about the Constitution doesn't need to be rewritten, it needs to be reread, I was just thinking about history and, you know, how much the last couple of years out of political reasons has been torn down, you know, things that people found offensive. And, you know, that was historic for one thing. It was also art. You know, some of that art was, you think about, well, I'll think about the art in Italy for a moment, which I was blessed to get to see all the Michelangelo and all of that. And you think about the art getting destroyed because of a political difference or a religious difference and how sad that would be. And You know, not everything that got destroyed had a lily white reputation, but what I found is when we bury history and destroy history, it's bound to repeat itself. And so a lot of what was destroyed in the last couple of years was a lesson of where we don't want to go back and a reminder of how far we've come. And that's a long way that we've come. And had we not had the Civil War later, things would have never changed. So a lot of American blood was spilled to rid itself of a lot of, you know, the woke speak of today. You know, had the Civil War not happened and so many Americans been willing to spill their blood for the cause, then it wouldn't have changed. You know, nothing would have changed. So
anyway, interesting documentary, Kim, if the audience is interested, Ken Burns, who has made a lot of documentaries, of course, he has one that's come out about Benjamin Franklin, and I've watched some of it, and I have reservations about some of Ken's work, but it's not for me, this is not a place for me to make comments about. He's a very major documentarian. His documentaries do cover a lot of good ground and do a lot of good. But what's striking to me about Benjamin Franklin's documentary, the one about him, is the astonishing attitudes on all sides and the remarkable number of unintended consequences. And just to move into that, because actually it has a relationship to brain injury, because in the same way, Kim, that your brain injury in a flash changed the direction of your life, there are many unintended consequences to every step after a brain injury. And just to come back to Benjamin Franklin and how the American War of Independence got started, and even the American Civil War, I'm not a historian, and please forgive me if, as a former English and now proud American, I'm not correct on the details, but it seems like the pattern is that nobody anticipates what's going to happen next. And somebody like Franklin was trying to do things that he thought would help. He leaked a letter that was written by some senior American politician, thinking that the leaking of this letter would cause reconciliation. And it was basically like dumping a can of gasoline on the flames. It just had exactly the opposite result, because the letter was leaked to the newspapers in New England. And then Franklin became not the well-intentioned person, but the person who had inflamed everything. And then off he goes to England, where he's trying to present an argument to the people in London about what's really going on and how unrealistic it is to try to hold on to these independent-minded colonies, all raised with the same values and language as they brought with them from England. I take that back, of course, because they were Puritans, which was its own distinct set of views on life. So, but nonetheless, broadly speaking, and so when Franklin arrives in London, he's essentially abused by being put in something called the cockpit, where they harangue him for over an hour. This is where Henry VIII used to have cockfights. And so there's no concept. And what I love about the world and about history and about our lives is that even the smart people have absolutely no idea what's going to happen next. So why they didn't have a sensible conversation with Franklin and negotiate something out, why there wasn't a way that England and the United Kingdom could form a kind of federation, an early version, if you like, of the European Union, except one across the Atlantic. It's just all a shame. And with the American Civil War, and at the risk of offending listeners, my understanding there is that Lincoln was trying to explore some sort of transitional time during which some slavery would be okay. I mean, it's hard to imagine now, but I think that was the case. And I think when Spielberg made the film about Abraham Lincoln, there was quite a question about whether even to depict those secret negotiations, because Lincoln was a politician as well as a great president. And he was trying to find some way where the South could let go of slavery, but over a period of time. And then it all, I think, got leaked or blew up. And of course, then there was this catastrophic war where so many Americans died, often with cousins fighting cousins across the local border, or brothers and sisters fighting each other, a huge amount of loss of life. But I leave it to others to judge, but nobody had any concept, I think, of how catastrophic the war would be. And the idea of having sort of an intermediate time where some slavery would be okay, which nowadays just seems completely wrong-headed. I mean, it's just, what were they thinking? But they were trying to... They were trying to make the money work. They were trying to find some way. But anyway, I don't want to go too far off because it's not my area and I'm probably offending listeners. But I do believe that those are historically correct statements about how Franklin was treated in London and what President Lincoln was trying to do to stop there being a civil war and get rid of slavery over time. But there we go.
No, that is true. All of that is true. I think there was some agenda in there, but it happened the way it was supposed to. And when you talk about money and slavery, we won't go far into this, we'll go back to our topic, but you know, the slaves actually came from Africa and were sold by their own people. To colonists and others. And so slavery started in Africa with mercenary black individuals who wanted to make money by selling less fortunate ones off into slavery. You think about now, let's talk about sex trafficking a moment. You know, you take somebody who is maybe a woman who got started in this when she was 13 years old, and she's in her middle 20s now, and she's working for usually the male boss, the cartel, the pimp, whoever it is, and she goes out and shills and finds these young women. Truck stops, I hear, are a good place. Homeless, you know, these encampments, there aren't a lot of people that apparently care or are looking or know to look in those places for some of these people. And so they look for people that won't be missed or people that are vulnerable who can't fight. And that was really, you know, that kind of slavery is going on now, sex slavery, sex trafficking. And back
Indeed.
In the day, you know, where do you think those slaves came from? You know, they weren't here. They were brought here from their own people who wanted to make money from selling them.
Yes.
So it is unfortunate, but there's, you know, we carried on something that we didn't start. You know, people didn't look at things the same. That's the only reason I say what I do about history, because I don't think they thought they were doing anything wrong in the beginning. You know, a lot of slaves, though by virtue of the name slave being held without their will, that obviously sounds horrible. Many were treated very well and like members of the family. And I watched this show on PBS called Finding Your Roots.
Ooh.
And there have been quite a few. It's a genealogy show is what it is. And they take celebrities to get you to watch. And they do some of their genealogy. And when it was People of Color Month or whatever they, every month is something different now. And whenever that was, his shows that week, it's always three people, two or three people that the guy does their trees per show. So that would have been, let's say, 3, 6, 9, 12. Maybe 12 people that month on the four shows. And I was shocked, but not as shocked as the people who got their trees done, that they had the appearance of being black. We know them as some famous celebrity people of color. And when they went back through their family tree, they got back to a point, and then they do a DNA test. These people, everybody on the show agrees to do a DNA test, because then one of the things they do is show you someone else who's famous that you share a certain amount of DNA with and are thereby related in some way. Might be first cousin, might be eighth cousin, but in some way you're related. And 8 out of 10 of these people who are activists had white DNA in their family tree. Now, I won't even speculate how that can be. All I will say is you just don't know. You know, you just don't know. There's so many things we don't know when we make assumptions about things. And so when we kill history, we have to start over repeating history and can't continue learning because the history is in front of our face, and learn more about the truth, you know, what the truth is, and what we don't want to go back and replay. Look at the progress we've had, maybe not fast enough or enough for some, but a hell of a lot better than it was back in these days that we're talking about, and continuing to go, you know, I think the right direction. And
well, I would say,
I don't know.
Yes, but, and my yes but is that I think, Kim, it's fantastic that you look into your genealogy, and we all understand more about our history. One of the things that gives me pause, and again, I think it's because of brain injury and how it changed my life in the blink of an eye or in a flash, is that rather like when we look into history, what we see so clearly is a complete lack of awareness of what's coming next. And that's the only thing where I would say that's my yes, but. As we look at the past and celebrate the War of Independence and the fireworks and everything else, and I mean, my very special lady in my life, who everybody knows about at this point, has dogs, and they suffer. They made it through the fireworks. But this year, there's supposed to be drones. A lot of places were supposed to be switching from fireworks because of the noise and the ash afterwards. It used to be fine, but the trouble is now there's thousands of fireworks, tens of thousands, these huge, huge displays, and it really is a cloud plume that comes down and causes a bit of a problem and terrifies, as you say, Kim, terrifies the dogs, and they run away if they can. Anyway, we got through that last night. But when we look at the past, we should remember that we have no idea about tomorrow. And 2 days ago was, I think, the hottest day in the history, recorded history of Earth. And the polar caps are disappearing. I think the polar ice caps are the smallest they've ever been, something like that. And those are critical for reflecting heat back out to space. The Greenland ice sheet is shrinking faster than they thought. It's quite possible that we have now hit the point of no return or passed it. So I do think that while we consider history and learn from history, it's important on a general community level that we think about the safety of our community, not even now for the long term, but what's going to happen when the sea level rises. I am from England, and England has got many things wrong. In fact, we've touched in this show already on some of the things that England got spectacularly wrong, including how to deal with the colonies at the time of the American War of Independence. But there's one interesting thing that decades ago, they built a barrier at the mouth of the Thames that leads up to London, the famous Thames River, so that they can lower that to stop sea level rise flooding London. And I think they may have even had to enlarge that. I know that the city of Manhattan has built booms around sections of Manhattan. You may recall that there was flooding, very bad flooding in lower Manhattan, of a kind that had never been seen before, where the subway was flooded. And so in Manhattan, they're building barriers, again, to hold out the ocean. I do not know what Florida is doing to protect its coastline, but that's going to be something which collectively as a community, we should be looking at the science and considering how high is the ocean going to go in the models when all of the polar ice caps are gone. And perhaps a conversation about where the inhabitants of the Persian Gulf are going to go, because I certainly see models that suggest that the Persian Gulf may become too hot or too wet to be habitable along the coastline, because basically the map of the planet is vast amounts of ocean and all the people living right by the ocean. We're still basically coastal people living off the fish from the ocean, essentially. Now, how does this link to brain injury? Because now let's talk about the tomorrow, and I'm much more optimistic about the tomorrow for survivors of brain injury, because what we're talking about this evening is about things like central sensitization syndrome and all of the things that are being discovered that are gradually expanding our understanding of the brain. For a long time, as I've said before on the show, the area of medicine called neurology, basically the study of nerves, was referred to as the graveyard of medicine because there was no research being done on the nerves. There was nothing that could be done. If your nerves were severed, there was really nothing to do except in different ways encourage the patient to try to get used to it, try to accommodate to it. And that has changed so that now we're in a time of huge research, so that whereas global warming or climate change may mean that tens of millions of people are going to be on the march looking for dry land or cooler land in order to stay alive and find food. Individually, I think the future is very encouraging and some of the things we're going to talk about. But in terms of one thing I wanted to cover, we talked about your original host, Kim, and his difficulties with anger. And I was thinking back about this aspect of brain injury where people can act out and be angry. And an interesting aspect of that is relatively recent research, which is to answer the question, why do people swear so much after brain injury? And the interesting aspect of that, because there is a word, which I'm not going to try to remember now, because it's a technical word for the term of where people overreact and they use bad language and they act in a way that is socially inappropriate after brain injury. But the theory, and I'm reading this online from a man called Peter Twigg, a graduate student and research technician in a lab, I think at Temple University, called Peter Twigg. And he says, you see, in traumatic brain injury or aphasia, people may have these outbursts of cursing language that is preserved, while other parts of their vocabularies are lost, because, and this is a quote, it seems like cursing language may be coded differently by the brain. And I find that beautiful and fascinating, because as we start talking about central sensitization syndrome, one of the questions about the pain that people feel after brain injury is there's a growing understanding of how the brain is organized and how the thousands and thousands of different kinds of nerve cells that are in the brain are operating to make us the unique individuals that we are. But the theory that a person after brain injury might lean into cursing is because that area of their brain has been preserved, whereas other areas of their language and communication and cognitive skills may be damaged. To me, it's filled with hope, because if that's a signal of what has been preserved in that person's brain, and similarly to our troll caller, if indeed he has suffered from brain injury, what he's doing may reflect him using areas of his brain that have been preserved. He's using what's available to him to communicate. And again, that's why it's so wonderful, Kim, that you made it a learning opportunity about that there are programs, because one of my things I talk about a lot, and I wrote about in my book and all of that, is cognitive training. Because the core concept, and it's the importance of what you were describing to the caller, Kim, is that the brain doesn't self-correct all of these things automatically. We're used to the idea that if we cut our finger, the skin heals, the bleeding stops, and it heals itself, basically. The brain is much too complicated for that. And the brain is following a law of evolution. This is, by the way, my theory, and I'm not a doctor. I'm not recommending a course of treatment or action or anything like that. But the brain, because it uses such a lot of energy, it's this tremendous proportion of the body's energy gets sucked up into the brain to keep us going. So the brain has to be very economical. And when there's a damage such that some communication skills are lost, or there's a blurring of divisions between the motor cortex and the sensory cortex, so the signals are getting a bit jumbled. And that's one of the reasons we'll talk about that leads to chronic pain. If the brain can be trained, if you can do cognitive training, there may be a way to restore some of the normal pre-trauma balance. But the point that I want to share is that the brain won't fix itself, because that takes energy. And the brain, through evolution, is much more commanded to keep your body going, to keep your breathing going, to keep track of your temperature, to to monitor your heart and your heart rate and your blood pressure. It has to do all of these things as well as in one part of the brain manufacture the tiny amounts of individual drugs that the body needs to handle certain things like pain and inflammation. However, if you do targeted cognitive training, it forces the brain to try to build fresh connections. The thing we talk about often, Kim, it forces neuroplasticity, or it may do so. Depending on the level and extent of the brain injury, if there's a complete severing or if there's been a massive stroke, the amount of rewiring may be less than otherwise. But I just want to say, on the general community level, looking at the past doesn't tell us what tomorrow will bring. Climate change is the thing to keep an eye on in your community for your personal safety. It's something to think about because the authorities never deal with things that are either far away or too expensive to do anything about in reality. They'll pretend that it's to do with a moral issue. It's remarkable that in England they built a barrier that they can lower at the head of the Thames. I don't know what the solution is for a country with a very large coastline with millions and millions of people living right next to the coastline. So the tendency is not to talk about it because they don't have the resources to fix it. So if you want to be ahead of the game, that's something to keep an eye on as your, in terms of your community and safety. In terms of being ahead of the game individually after brain injury, listen to shows like this one and constantly keep looking for the new information. I keep track of things. To give just a couple of examples, because I just love the fact, Kim, that you give me an opportunity to share these sorts of things for people who are interested in making the most of each day. Sucralose. There was a very interesting piece of research. One of the aspects that we are making great advances on in terms of the brain is the back door to the brain that connect from the digestive system. There's still a lot that is not understood, but it's the vagus nerve, because if you think about it, possibly even in your coma, I don't know, because I was on full life support and I was in a coma for over a month. But the vagus nerve is controlling the digestive, that motion of moving food through the digestive system. If you think of us in evolutionary terms as entities with legs and hands to move around, to find things to put in our mouths to eat and digest and shed after we've got the nutrients, that is a pretty core evolutionary function that we have. And that suggests, again, this is not fully, not even a little understood, that there are fundamental connections between what's happening in the digestive system and the brain. One of the fascinating things is that people with autism spectrum disorder, about which so little is understood, again, more research is being done, is that it is very typical that people with autism spectrum disorder have digestive problems. And the theory that there's now some early promising results on is if the causes of autism have to do with it during pregnancy, and the issue is some kind of dysregulation of how the brain manages digestion, is it possible by correcting the digestion, actually adjusting the microbiome in the digestive system, to train the brain in the reverse direction? And they're beginning to do some work with that. there's some new research that is suggesting that a common aquatic bacterium is related to Alzheimer's. Now, things like Alzheimer's have many causes, so we're not looking for a cure here. We're simply looking for what's called not causation, but correlation. And there appears to be a correlation between this common aquatic bacterium. So if you're eating lots of raw seafood, for example, and you're ingesting a lot of this common bacterium, it seems to be possible that that disruption in the digestive system could be working its way back up the vagus nerve and affecting the brain. And another fascinating insight, which I just read about the golden future that we have if we can keep going and stay abreast of the research. There's some new research that was published about a common food sweetener called sucralose. S-U-C-R-A-L-O-S-E. And I spell it so that you can then look up the research and see whether you think it's interesting. One of the things that was unusual is that the researcher publishing the research actually made a recommendation, which they never do. It's not their job. That's and it's way overreach. But the results that the researcher got were so strong that they said, I wouldn't eat any food that has sucralose in it. And what was it that they were looking at? It turns out that sucralose is a, I'm trying to remember the right term for it, I'll come back on that, but right now what I'll tell you is that it has the effect of dissolving our DNA. They've actually established that sucralose breaks down into another product, which is something like genotoxic, I think that's the word. Genotoxic, which means it's toxic, and it starts to break down. And the theory is that this genotoxicity, where does it go? The cells lining our digestive system. And it, you may have heard the term leaky gut syndrome, which has always been a little bit doubtful. Because it's a syndrome, so it's always measured by the symptoms. But I read out to you what I found. New research shows a chemical found, and I won't name the product because I'm not here to recommend eating or not eating certain foods, but it's a common sweetener, I'll just say that. It shows the chemical found is sucralose 6 acetate is genotoxic, causing DNA damage. The findings also show that sucralose is harmful to gut health, may lead to oxidative stress, inflammation, and even cancer. And why am I going to this? Because this has an effect on the brain. It has to. Because of the vagus nerve and the stress, the oxidative stress. The reference to inflammation is important, because one aspect of the brain and pain is that brain injury commonly causes inflammation wherever the person is hurt.
Yes.
What Kim and I are talking about separates out acute from chronic pain. Kim talked about her fall. I fell immediate chronic pain across my body, the sprained ankle, the bashed knees. And of course, brain injured people know how to fall, so I know how to fall, but I don't know how to avoid a countertop when I fall. So my head hit the countertop, so a bit of a mess. But I will be okay. But all of the pain centers of the body were activated, and I don't recommend courses of action or products. But I can tell you what I do when I have pain, if it's acute. I find a product that works for me, which is what I've done, and I work very quickly to try to reduce the inflammation, because there's a theory that many of the problems that we have flow from things that cause inflammation. So when that word inflammation is used in the research findings about sucralose, or specifically sucralose-6-acetate, and they always have the weasel words, it may lead to oxidative stress inflammation. So they're not saying it does. This is brand new research. But I take steps with my chronic pain, which is across my whole body. And as you probably know, you feel different areas at different speeds. So at first it was where my head hit, and then it was where my knees hit, and then gradually, like 24 hours later, my entire body. But I did the icing immediately, and the other thing, try to reduce the inflammatory response, because you want to try to limit the amount, and sometimes it's heat. So I don't recommend, it might be heat, it might be cool, but it's whatever the doctor says to bring down the swelling. Don't wait for a couple of hours, but immediately. Just you try to prevent the swelling bringing too much hyperactivity to the area. Of course, if you've broken something, I 18 months ago fell and broke my left arm, emergency room. You tend to know if you've broken something because, for evolutionary reasons, you instinctively cannot do something. When I fell and broke my arm, I was by my car. Because of adrenaline, I was lifted up by the people I was with, planted on my feet. I walked to my car. I got into my car. I put my hands on the steering wheel. And I announced to my mother, who was with me, of course, she was with me all the time. I was very calm about it. I said, I cannot lift my hand off the steering wheel. I think my arm must be broken. And that's typically how you know. Because it's evolutionary, it's instinctive. I don't know quite what is occurring in the body, but the body and the brain shuts down. And I couldn't, even if my life depended on it, I had to use my other hand to lift that second hand off the steering wheel. I lifted it up to put it on the steering wheel, but by that point, the instinctive response had kicked in. Somewhere the body, this amazing machine that drives us all, phoned in and said, left arm is down. That's it. And you can't hide that. But left arm is down. So, but once that kicks in, that's how you know. But I was weight bearing. I'm basically walking with only one leg, but I know, I believe the ankle is not broken because my brain has not switched off my left leg. But that is what tends to happen.
I would still, depending on when it is, maybe have x-rays done, because when I fell last year, not this one where I bunged my knee a couple weeks ago, but where I broke my foot in two places and a chip out of my ankle, I walked on it for 2 days thinking it was sprained. And so
A great point. And I must answer you, that's a great, great point. I try to watch myself. And I have a different problem with my left foot. And I had just that day called in to my foot doctor, my podiatrist, to advance my next appointment. Unfortunately, he advanced it to Friday. And the same day that I called to advance it, because I knew my balance was being more limited because of my general problems with my foot. But to answer your question, Kim, absolutely. I'm actually, because of that advancing of my schedule, I'll be in on Friday. So, yes, you are absolutely right. Can't take it for granted. I might have a broken bone in my foot.
Well, I wouldn't have known it. It was just super swollen, and I was limping. And you hear that often that sprains hurt worse than breaks, and I just, because I couldn't walk well. I do understand what you're saying, and that's true. When I broke my femur, totally different story. You're going nowhere, you know.
Yes.
But that ankle thing, the swelling was getting so big, and by the third day, that was the day I got out of bed and couldn't walk, and Gary acted as a crutch and got me to the doctor. And when he came back after doing these x-rays and said, well, you really did quite a job. You broke two places in your foot and a chip out of your ankle bone. And I had no idea. I just thought it was a sprain. Now, fortunately for me, they broke with everything in line still, not the chip that came out of my ankle, but the break, it was my pinky toe bone, and the bone didn't separate. It was just broken in two places. And this was in the middle of the pandemic, and I was so grateful that I didn't need surgery or anything like that. But what I did need to do was wear one of those obnoxious boots and walk on crutches for 6 months.
Sadly, Kim, sadly, I have one of those obnoxious boots from when I last needed it. And so I actually have one in stock. And when my mother drives me down to the hospital, it will be in the trunk and come with. So the only good news is if I need a boot, I won't need to buy a new one. Although I take that back. There's always a new latest and greatest model. So there'll be a new one.
Nah, I just got mine last year, so they can't be too much different. What was different, though, was crutches. And boy, did I not get along with crutches very well. You know, they were, last time I needed them in 77, believe it or not, when I broke my femur, they were all made of wood. And you had to go in and get them cut. You know, you had to be measured, and they would cut the wood to make it the right size for you. And there was a lot more padding where you held on to it and under your armpit. The rubber was much, much thicker. And now it is handy to be able to buy one set of crutches and use screws, you know, to adjust them to the right height. But I will say that I was not impressed at all with the place that you hold it, the crutch or the part under your armpit, compared to 77, the padding, it was much less comfortable, especially when you're walking with it all the time. But I'm going to let you finish up. We've got like 15 minutes left. And the only reason this topic came up, and I just want to give a website to people, is the thing that I sent to you. The word central sensitization syndrome was new to me. I had no idea what that meant. Something that sounds like that alludes to a treatment for PTSD that often involves EMDR, and I thought that's what my doctor was talking about. It wasn't. Something totally different, this central sensitization syndrome, or CSS. And what he told me was, you know, now my doctor was pretty, well, I can't even think of a word for it, but when I was in for my physical, he talked about going to a continuing education program that I might be interested in because he thinks it may resemble me. But then he just kind of pooed it off. To him, it was a continuing ed class. But when he knew that I did my show and that I have issues with my neck and my spine, chronic pain issues, a few years after my brain injury, I got fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome. And it was just weird that I got these chronic pain conditions after suffering this brain injury. And what I've gotten for all these years is pills thrown at symptoms or getting sent to a shrink to talk about what might be going on. What I really liked about this continuing ed course that my little doctor went to was a concept that empowers you to know that what you're feeling is real and that the pills, again, I'm not a doctor, but all the pills were given here, usually they mask the problem. They don't fix the core of the problem or give an explanation for it, nor do they feel like giving an explanation when the automatic answer is just sending you to the shrink. Because he can talk to you about how you feel about your problem, but if talking about it isn't going to fix it any more than taking a pill did, it's nice to be validated and know that people are doing research. So I came home, he told me, I wrote down what he said, central sensitization syndrome. The person that he saw in the continuing ed do a presentation was a Dr. Christopher Sletten, S-L-E-T-T-E-N. And I came home, I've taken to, somebody told me I watched too much news a long time ago. So I quit watching the news. I like to test things out. I can be open-minded. And I started watching YouTube videos, part of it on the book I was writing that I guess I'm not at the moment, but we'll pick it back up when the Ferris wheel of life quits going so fast. But I looked up Dr. Christopher Sletten. He works with Mayo Clinic down in Florida, and he does a presentation with a whiteboard on this central sensitization syndrome, and it talks about the brain and a lot of what Simon was talking about. You know, I remember hearing in the beginning of brain injury that the brain didn't feel pain, and I thought, well, you ain't living in my head. I don't know. I don't even know where all that came from way back then, but anyway, it appears that they're thinking a little differently, like that leaky gut connection seems to be pretty substantiated now with enough studies because enough are talking about it and making the connection. But anyway, you can go to YouTube, and if you just look up Dr. Christopher, C-H-R-I-S-T-O-P-H-E-R, Sletten, S-L-E-T-T-E-N, and that's all I did was looked up Dr. Christopher Sletten Mayo Clinic, and his video came up. It's a man in a shirt with a tie and a whiteboard behind him, and he takes you through a discussion of the central sensitization syndrome, which is the prevailing theory of the cause of chronic pain and other chronic symptoms. A patient and or provider understanding of this process can lead to seeking appropriate treatments. And so it's a different take. I've had a lot of different, gone to a lot of different pain clinics in my tenure since I've developed some of these chronic conditions, and I believe that they came from my brain injury in one way, shape, or form, timing, I guess. And in fact, now they're even looking at post-COVID syndrome as well as a lot of other chronic pain conditions and connecting it back to the brain and where it registers. So anyway, it's an interesting, it's 22 minutes. So if you've got 22 minutes and you just want to watch a quick tape on a doctor from Mayo Clinic running through this theory that they're talking about. What you'll see is what you normally see on YouTube. If you start there and watch this guy's 22-minute presentation, it is interesting, but then after it's over, if you let it go, you're going to see that a number of videos, have been made about this. So I had just watched it, I think, when I posed it to Simon. Do you want to talk about this? Because I know an awful lot of people who have had a brain injury who wind up with chronic pain issues, whether it was something that happened, like in your case, you had so many physical injuries at the same time as your brain injury because of the accident, that it's not surprising that you would have chronic pain issues from everything that was broken. Now, in my case, I feel like it's kind of like the fallout, reflecting about what you talked about that fall that you had, because you're right. When I fell, and I fell on my knee and my wrist, I addressed my knee and my wrist, and it was later the next day that I had that feeling that I got in a car accident where, what you said, every nerve ending in my body was in pain. And yes. I already have issues down my spine and in my neck, so that winds up giving me a headache. So anytime you take a jolt, you know, whether it's a fall or whatever that jolt may be from, in fact, where I got my neck issue was a whiplash concussion from another fall in 2015, I think it was. But anyway, I talked longer about that than I wanted to. But anyway, YouTube, Dr. Christopher Sletten, S-L-E-T-T-E-N, Mayo Clinic, and you can read a little bit, not read, excuse me, you can have a man tell you for 20 minutes a little bit about this condition that we're talking about and the relation between the brain and some of these chronic pain conditions. And a lot of it has to do with when we get a brain injury, our central nervous system can kind of go sideways, and that leads to a lot of the things that Simon was talking about and Dr. Sletten is talking about. So at some day we may revisit the topic down the road a ways, but I had just heard about it, and because my doctor mentioned it to me that this is something that was being taught in continuing education for internists, at least that's what he is, and chose to take the course for continuing ed, he must have seen some merit in it, and it's being looked at seriously enough that they're offering it as a continuing ed course for doctors. So check it out, YouTube.
And yes, I have a number of things to offer about this area. And thank you, Kim, because it's a great thing that you do, is you bring these things. I hadn't focused on this or heard of this even, central sensitization syndrome. A couple of things I would say. The first is, it's interesting it's being offered as continuing education. The need for solutions to pain is immense. That's where the opioid epidemic came from. It didn't come from big bad companies, etc., etc. It came from a product being manufactured with inappropriate or insufficient or very limited research. That was how it all began. There wasn't proper research done in terms of its addictiveness. But the extent of the need for pain relief, because most people who have pain need the pill or the procedure to get back to work as soon as possible. So when any tool comes along that might be added to the toolkit so that doctors can do something for patients in pain, it's valuable and it gets adopted into their continuing education. So that's, I think, where that comes from. And I think it's a good thing if one advances with the same caution as one advances with all of these things, because yes, the drugs, all the different drugs work so very well, but they were addictive and it destroyed many, many lives. I don't think there's the same risk with this, and I think that's one reason why the doctor that Kim is describing has gone with it. I have a couple of specific suggestions and questions. If you're going to go to such a program, it might be a good question to ask them, have they done any outcome studies? Because as a patient, what you'd like to know is how many patients have gone through this program and what outcome studies have been done on them to assess benefit. That would be a very positive thing if indeed the program says, yes, here's our outcome. It might be a small number of patients, but we've done 300 patients and 200 say they're feeling a lot better, especially if the outcome study is repeated a bit later, because the issue is, how is the person 2 months later, did the pain come back? Were the benefits extended or were they temporary? And one of the issues about this whole area is the use of the word syndrome, central sensitization syndrome. If you think back to your lifetime in medical needs and medical treatments, nobody says you've got malaria syndrome, or you've got AIDS syndrome, or you've got flu syndrome or measles syndrome. You've got flu. You've got malaria. The difference is that with things like flu, malaria, AIDS, and so forth, there is a known pathological diagnosis of what you got. The word syndrome denotes that it's not a pathological condition. It's not a pathological diagnosis. It's a clinical diagnosis, where it's a description. The syndrome is a description of that a patient has come into the clinic describing this set of clinical symptoms that match as a pattern to this described phenomenon. The difficulty with following syndromes, and there's no harm, it's a good thing because there's benefit. I mean, it's describing a pattern of symptoms that you may have. But it's important to recognize that what is being treated are the symptoms. And you're not alone. There's a piece of research that I just want to mention. We're almost out of time. I'll just say this one piece of research. It says neurometabolite alterations in traumatic brain injury and associations with chronic pain, published by Frontiers in Neuroscience, published online February the 23rd of this year. And I'll skip down to just one fact. It says at a certain point, incidentally, more than 50% of individuals with TBI report chronic pain. The reason why in the closing minutes I wanted to say that is so that you should know that even though I'm talking about syndromes and it's a clinical diagnosis, not a pathological diagnosis, the reason that Mayo and these other programs are trying to address it is that more than half of individuals with TBI report this. And this syndrome covers a large group of disorders like fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, chronic headache, temporomandibular disorders, that's with the jaw, pelvic pain syndromes. Mm-hmm. And they share common symptoms. It's a pattern of symptoms with persistent pain being the most prominent feature. So as we're in the closing minutes, I'll just say that if you watch the piece for Mayo Clinic, remember to ask about outcome studies, both short-term and long-term. to try to find programs which can prove a track record of bringing benefits to patients with persistent pain.
Hang on one second, Simon. I'd like to thank everybody. You stay on for a minute. Thank everybody for listening tonight. I'll be back next week. I want to thank Simon. Thank Michael for stopping in and tell you good night. Good night and God bless. The tape has stopped rolling, but we're still going. The only thing I wanted to say was one thing. I really appreciate you reading that last sentence, and you're not going to believe it. You raise a good question by questioning what this guy has to say. But you know what struck me is how many times since 1995 that I've been into different pain clinics and have been doubted and sent to a shrink or, you know, given a few rounds of, and I've done it all, EMDR,
yes.
Acupuncture, acupressure, somato release.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Everything that I can do, every drug I can take. You know what my takeaway from that presentation was? Not even as
What's
complex
that?
As where you went, was the admission of a professional that it's real. And I got to
yes.
tell you, there would be a lot of people like me who've gotten the bum's rush for these chronic pain things, meaning it stays with us. You know, the flu, those kind of things don't stay with us, but chronic pain conditions do, you know, and there's things that make them flare where it's really unbearable, and then there's the chronic pain the rest of the time. This guy's whole presentation, my takeaway from it was, thank you, God, somebody is finally admitting that it's real. So for all of you people with chronic pain conditions who've had a brain injury, who've been led to doubt what you're feeling, which you're feeling it, it's very real, but a professional is telling you maybe not so much, or flipping a pill at it, or suggesting, you know, some things that might make you not feel validated in what you're so desperately trying to get some relief from, is it was a huge thing to me just to have that phrase and that tape or that video
yes.
to take into a pain clinic and say, you know anything about this? And
yes.
I don't even have
yes.
to say anything because he's admitting it's real, it's true, it's nothing people are making up. And he used an example just real quick, like, because it happened to me today, but he used the example of people feeling pain who have had a limb amputated and they can still feel pain. And then he said,
yes.
and what about a person who has broken their ankle 3 years ago, but or broken their foot or their ankle, and it still hurts today, you know, three years ago. And mine does when I walk. I can't walk barefoot anymore because it really
yes.
hurts that pad on the underneath under my toe feels like it hurts my bone when I'm walking barefoot. Now I'm fine in all of my shoes now are health shoes, I'll call them. I don't like to call them anything that makes it sound old, but they're healthy shoes, you know, with orthotics and things like that in them, and I don't have any problem. But my foot still hurts 3 years later after breaking it when I try to walk barefoot. So in any case, just having validation sometimes, because we get so much of the opposite through the course of our journeys, that was my takeaway. But Simon does
thank you,
go a step
thank
further.
You, Kim, for Well, thank you, Kim, for letting me slip it in at the end of the show, because it was so curious that that article that I read does use the word incidentally. And it's like, oh, by the way, and it's this huge critical fact that more than half of individuals are TBI. And what was interesting about the article is the research was being done into the microbiology as to what is occurring, different from Dr. Schetter's with the sensitization. They're talking about neurometabolite alterations in TBI and associations with chronic pain. That's why I was saying earlier in the show that it's an extremely positive time, as long as we survive climate change, that this research is being done, because this is looking at the underpinnings of how do we measure what's happened in a brain and why is it causing chronic pain. So it's pretty exciting. That was February the 23rd of this year, so that's pretty brand new. But then I'll read this out to you, because if I have a minute, I'll say it. Survivors of TBI experience a wide range of physical and mental health problems, including sensory, motor, behavioral, and neuropsychological deficits. And that's part of the problem, isn't it, Kim, that everything gets jumbled up. So there's this mixture of physical injuries, neuropsychological deficits, behavioral, the swearing, and physical and mental health. But then the article turns to the question of pain, and I thought that was, there's this clinical study suggest that many TBI-associated symptoms, including pain, persist over an extended period. And that's where the line, incidentally, more than half report chronic pain. They actually put a number to it. So yes, and this thing about it's psychological or pop a pill, happy pills, as one clinician said to me, yes, we can turn you into a fully functioning, sociable drug addict. That's what that was occurring, because they were so addictive, these drugs, so the person could be out of pain, not feeling pain, functional, but a literal drug addict. And then the tragedy, the human and family tragedy, is when financial support to give access to a drug like that is taken away, and the person is still suffering from terrible pain, and they don't have access to the painkiller. That's the right societal disaster that happened with the various high powerful opioid drugs.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, well, I am going to close this out with something appropriate for this last night, and I hear the last of the fireworks just stopped, so...
Oh, perfect timing. Happy 4th, Kim.
Yes.
Thank you.
And thank you, Simon. I'm going to close with, this is Dave Bray when he was with Madison Rising singing the Star-Spangled Banner. And I will see you all next Wednesday night. Thank you, Simon. Good night, and God bless everyone.
Good night.
Good night.
fucking